Welcome to Across the Desk and our new series in partnership with CASDA, the Canadian Autism Spectrum Disorders Alliance. This series is focused on the National Autism Strategy. We hope you'll join the conversation about how this strategy can help autistic Canadians have full and equitable access to the resources they need to live a full life. The time to have this conversation is now. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Across the Desk. My name is Elizabeth Plouffe, and I am the host of Across the Desk. Megan is smiling at me already. I don't know what to... What's that, Megan?
I'm a very, very smiley person.
You are a smiley person. And I'm really pleased to continue with our partnership podcast with CASDA, which is the Canadian Autism Spectrum Disorders Alliance. Autism is something that's very close to my heart because my son was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when he was 7 years old. I realize there's some controversy around that label, but that's what we have grown up with. So that's what we continue with right now. Rebecca's shaking her head. Okay, we'll get into that in another time. So today what we are doing is we are continuing to meet the editorial board of the, and I'm going to have to read it because we know I make this mistake, Canadian Journal of Autism Equity, which is a fantastic initiative that was just launched recently. And I'm going to introduce everybody, and then Megan is going to jump into a little explanation of the project, and then we get to meet these amazing people. So we're going to talk with Rebecca, who we've had the pleasure of welcoming to Across the Desk before. So she's a podcast pro now. Rebecca, diagnosed autistic in 2012, is a prominent autistic self-advocate from Kelowna, BC. Since her diagnosis, her advocacy has included writing extensively about autism in the context of health and policy, which has led her to be featured in a multitude of mediums, including magazines, news articles, webinars, the radio, and she has been quoted at the Senate of Canada. In addition to presenting her work at conferences, Rebecca is also a director at the Canadian Autism Spectrum Disorders Alliance, where she has published documents on language and autism. Most recently, she spoke at the United Nations Conference side event on the Convention of the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and is a founding member of the Canadian Journal of Autism Equity, where she continues her advocacy in championing the voices of autistic Canadians. Rebecca is also an Okanagan advisor for the Pacific Family Autism Network's Voices of Autism program. Nobody makes short names anymore, do they?
No.
Always long. Rebecca is very creative. Aside from loving to draw and write, she also appreciates cooking for her two boys, acting out scenes from Monty Python with them, and singing karaoke together. I'm telling you, if you put some ABBA on right now, I would be singing with you.
That's funny.
So we're also welcoming Mackenzie Salt. Dr. Mackenzie Salt was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome when he was 13 years old. Since then, he has tried to help the ASD community, both in his professional life and his personal life. He sat on the leadership council of a local chapter of Autism Ontario for almost 2 years while a graduate student, and he more recently served on Autism Canada's ASD advisory committee for 3 years. Dr. Salt completed his PhD in cognitive science of language in 2019, studying the communication abilities of autistic adults and developing a new method of studying language abilities in ASD by examining interactions between autistic adults. Well, we need to talk because I have an opportunity and we'll chat later. Dr. Salt is currently a member of the McMaster University Autism Research Team, also known as MACART, and is working on the pathways in ASD study. In addition, he has worked with a number of community and nonprofit organizations conducting research and service evaluation for the benefit of autistic adults, as well as the broader Canadian autism community. Okay, now we're going to go to Ryan Collins. And it's my first time meeting Ryan, so hello.
Hello.
Ryan Collins is a first-year PhD student in the Faculty of Education at York University, focusing on the creation of learning spaces for autistic students. Oh, we need to talk. He holds degrees in English, computer science, education, and science and technology studies. I'm feeling like I need to get more degrees. Ryan has been a high school teacher in the York Region District School Board since 2006 and is second vice president of the 108-year-old Linser Benefit Society. Very cool. Ryan lives with his wife and son in Ajax, Ontario. And now we are also joined by Megan. You have to come off mute.
Yes, I'm here.
So for a timestamp, we are still in the middle of the COVID pandemic, so we are meeting through Zoom, and mute is still a thing. So we have to be, just have to be very careful. Megan Kras, I always get it wrong. Krasnodemsky.
Yes, there you go.
Second time. I get it right. And sometimes I don't know.
You say every single letter. That's how you do it.
Need more consonants in there. Joined CASDA in 2019 as a communications student intern. Following her graduation from McGill University, she returned once again as a marketing and policy student intern in 2020 and is currently a special projects coordinator at CASDA. By day, you can find her supporting CASDA's many projects, including the Canadian Journal of Autism Equity. And in her spare time, she is an avid reader, aspiring polyglot, and amateur cook. What is a polyglot?
I love languages. I love learning languages. I keep adding languages to my library of knowledge.
Your library of languages. Just pull it out and off you go. I speak Fringlish is my only claim to language fame. Being born in Quebec, that's all I have. So Megan, can we hand it over to you for a second just to talk about the genesis? We have discussed it before, but just in case anybody's tuning in for the first time, can I hand that to you?
Yep, sounds good. So back in summer/fall of 2020, CASDA started having more and more discussions about equity. And with the movement, the Black Lives Matter movement and other movements that were similar going on at the time, we really thought, okay, now we need to have a conversation about equity. And that started the equity subcommittee at CASDA. And we really took an equity lens, looking at CASDA itself, looking at the equity barriers within our own organization and how to start addressing those and how to start moving forward to creating that equity and making sure that it is an equitable relationship. From there, we decided, you know what, this is a broader discussion and we need to talk more about it. It's not something that we can confine to our own organization. And then, so we decided to write an article, but that wasn't enough because there's so much to talk about. There's no way you can cover that. And we moved to a series, and then we ultimately ended up thinking, you know what, let's do a journal, making sure that autistic individuals have that first voice and that they are the champions and at the forefront of this journal. So CJAE has a policy where our majority of our articles are written by autistic authors or created by autistic creators to make sure that this conversation is really led by autistic individuals themselves. And that's pretty much it.
That is pretty much it, but it isn't. It actually leads us into our first article, which is awesome. It's a big journal, people. Got a lot of stuff in it already. And so if we can jump into, that's an excellent segue into Mackenzie's article, because part of Mackenzie's article talks about not going to the person and relying on parents' interpretation of situations and parental data versus first person data, which all I can claim from my experience with autism is my experience with autism. I do not know what it's like to live in my son's shoes. He's extremely verbal, extremely social. So it's not a question of, you know, mutism or inability to communicate. I just don't know, you know, his brain runs his way. I cannot claim to speak for him in any capacity. And so Mackenzie, when I started reading your article, I was like, heck yes, that was amazing. So if I can ask you to sort of give an overview of your article and how that came to be, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. So my article sort of focuses it on a bit of a research angle. I know, like, being a member of the research community, while also being a member of the autistic community, I sort of straddle a fence in some ways. I wear many hats. And one of the things that really comes up a lot when we talk about research engagement, which is a fairly new idea, and the idea is that if you're going to research a patient population of any kind, then you have people from that patient population provide input on the study as a whole. What methods are being used? How is it being analyzed? Not just are they going to participate, because that can just serve to repeat previous gaps and expose previous gaps in research and exacerbate them. And so one of the projects I'm working on right now is the Pathways in ASD project, which is a longitudinal cohort study looking at following three cohorts of children from diagnosis with ASD until 18-ish years old. And right now we're looking at potentially expanding this to look at the transition into adulthood and following some adults afterwards, because there is very little data about anything on autistic adults. And so as part of that, I'm designing a research engagement process for working with autistic adults to try and gather some information to help researchers decide what's important to the autistic community to research. And then we can then figure out, okay, what measures do we have to meet those needs? And when I did that, when I started working on that, I went back into the literature and I found that there were a lot of researchers who claimed to consult with the autism community, but all they did was they talked to parents of autistic children.
Not the same thing.
And it's not the same thing. Parents of autistic children have a very valuable contribution to give. However, they are not the entire autism community. And in the one study that I look at specifically in detail in this piece in the journal, they were looking at where should the Australian government set research priorities for school-age autistic children. And they looked at parents of primary school students, with the average student being around age 9, and parents of secondary school students, with the secondary school students' average age being around 14. And they sent them surveys and said, to the parents, and said, okay, can you rank these research priorities in terms of what you think are most important? And unsurprisingly, the most important things were the effect of autism on the family and the effect of autistic behaviors on the family. Those were ranked highest, whereas things like mm-hmm. social relationships and things were ranked near the bottom. When a person being the actual student in that situation, I remember when I was going through school and not having a lot of friends and trying to figure out dating and all that stuff.
You would have answered far differently.
I would have answered very differently. And especially with 14-year-olds, I'm sure they could have filled out the survey as well. But the researchers didn't give them that opportunity. And they explicitly said, we did not go to the children. We only asked parents, but we feel we've engaged with the autism community. And it's sort of, no, you've engaged with one section of the autism community. So the idea behind the article is sort of a call to action for researchers to sort of to go out of your comfort zone, work with people in the community, because in a lot of cases, parents of autistic children are convenient sources of information because they're easy to find, because the children might be going through a clinical program or a treatment program, and then you can talk to the parents and it may not require a lot of additional communicative supports or things like that that you may get when dealing with children who may be nonverbal or who may need assistive communication of some kind, or just may be children and may have difficulty expanding on what they're feeling.
To your point, a 14-year-old is more than capable. I mean, 14-year-olds are a hot mess no matter what you're doing, but I mean, I've been 14. We've all been 14. It's a hot mess time, like between zits and growing and trying to figure out what your life is doing. But there's a huge opportunity there to get data that's otherwise being lost and creating that human perspective of the autism experience that should not be negated in that way. And that's, I keep going because I when I read your article, I was like, heck yes. So
the real thing is, I think overall we just need to increase the diversity of voices being heard by the research community, and that's not just autistic voices, but a diversity of autistic voices, because my experience as a white male on the spectrum is going to be different than, say, Rebecca's being a woman on the spectrum. I can't necessarily relate to her experience, or people of color who are on the spectrum. We need that diversity of voices to be heard. And unfortunately, research samples where this engagement has happened are not always very diverse. And I think that overall, we just need more diversity in this engagement. So not just parents, not just the the white autistics that happen to be around. We need to get a much larger variety of voices and more variety of experiences, because that the different autism is a very heterogeneous condition. And in that heterogeneity, there is a lot of strength, but there's also a lot of variability in experience. So, and we need to really capture that if our research is going to benefit the community as a whole, we need to capture that that variability and understand it.
Would you posit that with the current research model relying on the family versus the autistic individual, you can be inadvertently confirming biases towards certain perceptions of the autism community because you're only looking at it through the parental lens versus the first person experience? And if we don't get that first person voice, you know, are we inadvertently perpetuating, you know, some of the myths and misconceptions? Because I mean, as a parent, when my son was little, that's all you're focused on. Right. And your view of the entire lifespan of the situation is extremely different than 10 years later. Right. So my son's now 23. My view on autism and that experience and the effect on our family is far different. I wish we had had the opportunity. You're focusing on education, you're focusing on social, you're focusing on community and all those types of things. I wish we had asked him more.
I think that you're absolutely right. And I think that you're really hitting the nail on the head there. And I think the way that researchers go about it needs to change. And
they do it the easy way.
There are many reasons why that can be the case. There are certain pressures, be it timelines, funding, and things. So there, research engagement as it is not a very common thing. It's happening more in childhood disability research. It's been going on with cerebral palsy research for almost 20 years, mm-hmm. But it's only recently been applied to autism and to other communities. So some funders are willing to give you the extra money to be able to do that. Some aren't. You might be under timelines with grants, and researchers may or may not be able to do it. So not doing it is obviously more convenient, but in my opinion, not very helpful.
You're just missing a huge opportunity. And that's where it bugs me, because as now the parent of an adult, I don't see any data influencing policies and processes and programs that directly impact or support my son. And what ends up happening from my perspective, and please feel free, is that it becomes a reactive situation versus a proactive situation. Because as a situation arises, you know, somebody makes a call somewhere in the government to say, oh, we should do something about that, versus had you taken the time to begin when somebody was 14 years old and collect their thoughts and their experiences and their conversations, that might have a more well-rounded impact on the future development for that person's lifespan and others. Absolutely. Similar to them. Oh, look at this. See? Smarticle particles coming out everywhere. So we're going to jump over to Ryan. And I have to confess, I am just getting acquainted with Ryan's article now, but I loved his opening line, which speaks to exactly what we're talking about right now, which is that first person experience. And he writes, I will always remember how to spell the word tender. The word was one of several I would be tested on in class somewhere around grade 5. My mother would quiz me over and over and over before these tests. That was me with math. And I still remember her sounding out the word, adding a syllable to emphasize that the second letter was an E, not an A. Ta-ender, over and over and over. We would do this every week. On Fridays, all the students were given a strip of paper. The teacher read out that week's words for us to write out, and then we would pass our strip to someone else to mark as the teacher put the correct spelling on the board. Then, inundated by disappointment, I would take my strip of paper home to show my parents that I managed to fail yet another test. The education system did not train my teachers to look for the patterns I was exhibiting. I had nearly illegible handwriting, serious spelling issues, a horribly messy desk, and no interventions created to assist me. This, despite having the ability to read well above grade level, it was not until grade 7 that I was diagnosed with dyslexia and dysgraphia. It was not until I was encouraged to use a computer to write my assignments that school finally became less stressful. I started to be more successful. I think that's part of what we're talking about, is creating those opportunities for success. And had somebody asked you, what's going on? You know, how could that have changed what was happening for you in grade five? So Ryan, I welcome you to chat about your article and what happened with that.
Thank you. I mean, the one commonality through all of those years of school before any of this was diagnosed was something about effort. Every report card would say he needs to apply more effort, because they didn't, the fact that I was strong in certain areas meant that the fact that I was weak in other areas meant I must not be trying. There couldn't have been a problem. It couldn't have been an issue. It couldn't have been a disability. It just meant I was obviously being lazy. That's why I couldn't spell, but I could read. That's why I could do well in math, but I couldn't do well in something else. Mm-hmm. I couldn't follow directions in gym or something. And so I think that's the main thing I was alluding to in the part of the article, is the fact that the teacher, rather than saying this student has this very strange profile where they're very strong in these areas, very weak in these areas, that's, we should look into that. It was just naturally assumed, well, this kid must be lazy. If we keep failing him, he'll eventually work harder. And so we just have to keep telling his parents, he's lazy, make him work harder, make him practice more at home. And the end result was my mother trying to become my teacher, and then a huge personal issue between the two of us that took years to resolve, because—
Oh, I hear you.
Yeah, exactly. And so eventually they took me to a child psychiatrist or a psychologist. And one of the things he told my mother was, you're not his teacher. The teacher's job is to teach him. You're his mother. You're supposed to be his mother. And so there was all this drama in the family that was created by the fact that there wasn't anything. And again, I don't blame the teachers, because I guess this was in the days before there was something that we're looking for. But we know these things exist now, and there's still no real place or policy or system in place to identify these things. The ability for a student to be identified in school is very complicated and convoluted.
Yep.
And unless you're familiar with the system, kids slip through the cracks all the time.
Yeah. So in addition to my son's autism diagnosis, he's also dyslexic, ADHD, has executive function gaps, and has a short-term to long-term memory integration issue, as well as a fine motor integration issue. So if you can give me another diagnosis, I can probably confirm or deny whether my son, he's a little melting pot of good fun.
No, exactly. My son, I try not to talk about him too much because he's a person on his own, but my son is also, he's 13 and has many of those issues. And again, with the school system, we've had good teachers who try very hard to be supportive, and we've had bad teachers who, you know, scarred him. We tried putting him in French immersion in grade one because it was homeschool. So we figured if it didn't work, we could transfer him out. It wouldn't be a different school. It was worth trying.
Yeah.
And in the November report card, the report card came back. The little box we should meet wasn't checked, but we figured we should check in anyway. And the teacher told us, well, he hasn't been sitting on the carpet during circle time, and so he hasn't been paying attention to the most important part of the day. So he's really far behind. And especially the teacher, when I asked, how can we catch him up? She said, well, I don't think we can at this point.
But nobody had brought that to your attention.
Nobody brought it to our attention.
Until you advocated.
And as I'm also a special education teacher for high school, and I would never, ever tell a parent, we can't do it. It might be hard, it might be tricky, but I would never say, I don't think we can do that now. And if it was something we couldn't do now, then that's my job should have been to do it months and months earlier. And so to this day, he hates for the idea of taking French in school because, and he'll tell you, his grade one teacher ruined French for him.
So we had an interruption there, and my internet is being super fun. And in COVID, we all know that internet and Zoom has been our friend and enemy, and I think we're all sick of both of them. But my internet is cycling on and off right now, which is super fun times. So we were in the process of chatting with Ryan around his experience in school and now his son's experience in school, and how part of the problem could have been solved had somebody just asked him what was going on. So continue from there.
So the beginning end of it all was that when I went back to school for my fifth degree, one of the things,
overachiever.
I used to joke that I wanted more letters after my name than in it, and I passed that like 2 degrees ago, and I'm still going. I'm doing a PhD.
Well done, you.
Figure that'll be the last one because you don't really need multiples of those unless you're a Marvel superhero. They all have like six and seven of those.
Six and seven of those. Sorry, I'd missed the.
PhDs.
PhD. Oh. Yeah. Let's start talking Marvel. We could go off on a scroll with that, and that's not going to be conducive to the conversation.
I know. That's why I threw that in there.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So one of the things when I was doing my honors thesis, I was looking at autism, and I was looking at the way policy around autism is done. I was doing science and technology studies, and one of the fields within that larger field is expertise. Perry Collins and Evans did a lot of work on who is an expert, how do we decide what an expert is lived expertise the equivalent of training and so on.
Absolutely.
Spent hours. I don't want to leave any of the authors out, so I'm not going to talk too much about the specifics. But that was where my supervisor told me to look. And so I did a lot of research on the Ontario Autism Program. This was just before the Ford government took over. So this is while the Liberals were still in power. So this is the original OAP. And then while I was doing this research, Ford took over and changed the whole thing. And so it was all in the newspaper, but all the stuff in the newspaper was about the one I wasn't studying. So everyone thought I was, my timing was perfect as usual. And one of the things I found was that almost all the people involved in writing the policy were, as Mackenzie was saying, they were parents of autistic people. They were people who worked with autistic people. They were education people who had worked with autistic people. But there were no autistic people involved anywhere. And so that became sort of the area I started looking in. And just this idea of, like, is there a reason why don't we consider their lived experience to be expertise of some value? Why do we value someone who worked with autistic people's experience of autism more than someone who grew up as an autistic person, and so on? And so that's sort of where I got my start. And that's sort of where the beginning of all this came from, where I became radicalized, so to speak, was looking at it. It's because I was interested in my son. I was interested in better options for him, but I wasn't really that interested in the wider range. I have mechanisms in place to deal with my dyslexia, my dysgraphia. Nowadays you can order things on the internet, so you never have to pick up a phone. It's the greatest thing ever. So a lot of these difficulties, I found ways to get around over the course of my life. But now I was starting to become interested in how do we design policy around this? And being a teacher, how do we design education policy around this? Because that's something that my different expertises all could tie into. Yeah. And so for my master's project, what I wanted to do was get a bunch of people, autistic people who had gone through the school system, and a bunch of teachers, and have them meet together and figure out how they would design the perfect inclusive classroom. And then COVID hit.
Yeah.
And so doing this became extremely complicated. On one side, doing things online was easier for the autistic participants. On the other hand, the educators were completely swamped with the fact they now had to figure out how they're going to teach online. And they had a bunch of stuff to deal with. So the participation wasn't as good as I would have hoped, but we still got some very interesting things out of it. For example, in one of the introductory surveys I had, I asked both sides, how well do you think teachers are prepared to work with autistic students? And both sides agreed, not very much. Neither agree nor disagree. Everything was either disagree or strongly disagree that I am prepared or I am able to or I'm well trained in this area. And so that's a problem. And so while there are lots of people who take special education as qualifications, it's a very generic term. So I have my special ed qualification, and it actually was specifically in autism, but a special ed additional qualification doesn't necessarily require autism. There's no autism special education qualification specific. Mm-hmm. And so teachers don't really have the educational support at that level. So that's another thing I'm looking at as someone who's in the education faculty at a university doing graduate work. Mm-hmm. What are our options? How do we prepare pre-service teachers to deal with the fact that it's going to be autistic students in their classroom? And some are going to be undiagnosed completely, and some are going to have a diagnosis that might just be the dyslexia or dysgraphia, because I wasn't diagnosed. It wasn't until I went back to get the paperwork for when I went back to York as an adult that I needed, paperwork to be registered with disability studies. I had the autism diagnosis. Previous to that, the person at Queens who diagnosed me said, "We have enough here for a diagnosis that indicates you need a note taker, and we could do a bunch of stuff, but you're not getting anything more for that. So we have everything we need. We'll just stick with this diagnosis of dyslexia dysgraphia. It's good enough for now." Mm-hmm. But there are additional built training. There's additional techniques. Additional things that I could have had access to had they had the resources to do a more thorough examination. And so all of those things in a huge ball somehow will turn into whatever it is I do for my project in this PhD.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that. So education and autism is something that's a bit of a trigger for me because of the experience that we had with my son. And it's interesting because not only would the education system not listen to my son's voice, but they wouldn't listen to mine either. And it wasn't, my lived experience as his parent and how I supported his behavior changes. And, I parented, I'm learning now very differently than a lot of autism parents do it. I was a hard nose. We'll go with hard nose. But Thomas related really well to personal stories, personal attachments to the behavior change. Mm-hmm. So if I could explain to him and connect it to either his sister or my husband or, whatever, then he got it. Mm-hmm. And the number of teachers that I said to them, look, if you're having a behavior challenge, please reach out. There is a way I can help you do this. And one behavior went on for 3 months to the point where parents pulled their daughter off the bus because Thomas had a crush and he was trying to relate to her. And it was like Mackenzie mentioned, that whole Ako Taco trying to learn how to turn a friend into a girlfriend situation. And instead of involving me in the conversation and using the skills I had offered, they tried to deal with it on their own. And it escalated to the point of beyond almost unrepairable. And I ripped a strip off the teacher. I said, everything you've asked of me, I have come to the meetings, I have had the conversations. Why would you let this go on so long to the point where this poor girl is now upset? Parents are upset, whatever. Well, I thought I could handle it. Mm-hmm. I looked at him and I had crotchety face and I'm like, how'd that work out for you?
That's the grade one teacher I was talking about. Also, she had worked with autistic students in some other context before. So she thought she knew what she was doing.
Sorry, I'm using air quotes that people can't see, but oh my gracious, there are voices that are trying to have the conversations around these changes. And everybody who is affected by it, teachers, specialists, you know, service providers, whatever, needs to listen. Yes, Rebecca.
I think what happens a lot of times is that service providers and people helping autistics fall into the behavior trap, where they're trying to work with the behavior instead of what is causing the behavior. And it's like, you fell in the trap again, what do you expect? Yeah. And I'm never surprised when I see that. And the only thing that surprises me is
when it doesn't?
it's just like, why, you know, when they say, like, if you're doing something the same way all the time.
Oh, definition of insanity.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result.
Right. And yeah. I'm like, you're not going to get what you want by doing the same thing, by just trying to treat this behavior. First of all, you shouldn't be treating anything. And second of all, it's not the behavior you should be looking at.
It's the human. The behavior is secondary to something else that's going on. It's indicative of a deeper mm-hmm. issue that needs to be explored. And that's where the voice is so important, whether it is sometimes, and I'm speaking from my experience, my son and other autistic Canadians I've worked with just don't have the ability to express what is going on. And that's totally fine. We'll get there. Like, we'll figure a way to find the vehicle that you need to share what your experience is, because that's what needs to influence the next steps, mm-hmm. right? And that's the whole point of this journal, is to provide those voices so that it can influence next steps with an informed conversation, versus like Mackenzie's point around going to secondary sources and creating situations that are not beneficial. I could segue into the school system. We won't do that. But a point that you brought up, Ryan, actually leads us into Rebecca's article. And you talked about how in the classroom, the different modalities that you've come up with to deal with your dyslexia and dysgraphia and those supports and what have you. And in Rebecca's article, she talks about the medical model and goes into the level of adaption. Like, why aren't we looking at an adaptive model versus a curative model? And Rebecca, can I invite you to chat a bit about that? I can read the beginning part here if that opens it up.
My article discusses the medical model of disability and its use in Canada. The medical model is criticized for seeing impairment as the most important part of the person and suggesting that the person is helpless to do anything about this kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. It's not great. It suggests that a particular problem will always mean that the person can't be equal. So I also discuss the autistic and disabled community's preference of using a social model of disability instead. This is a long-standing preference. While the social model of disability offers much the medical model of disability cannot, there is a model of disability that includes both what the medical and social model can and goes above this even. So that's what I kind of discussed in there.
Yeah, and I went through and I highlighted some stuff that I just wanted to share. It's a really well, I mean, all of them are well-written articles. And this one, ooh, we have a kitty cat. This one, as we go into it, you make a really valid point and towards the beginning is, I have questions about a model of disability where disability is interpreted as a negative that needs to be fixed or cured. That language drives me bananas. Where autism is seen as something that can and needs to be treated. A model of disability where autistic behaviors are seen as symptoms that can and should be eliminated and or reduced does not come across as socially equitable for the disabled person. It does not reflect the whole of who I am, how society is involved with my disability, how it is that my environment impacts me, and how all of this plays a role in my health and well-being. Heck yes.
Yeah. So the medical model is, it's not helpful for the way that we frame our language and how it becomes or doesn't become equitable for the people who are disabled. And that's kind of what I was trying to say in that sentence, mm-hmm. paragraph.
Well, the whole article is, and this is why this journal is so important, because again, you are bringing the autistic perspective to the models that have been put in place. And if I may use this language, sort of forced upon the autistic community, not giving options. I mean, for another health issue that my son had, I sought naturopathic support, not instead of Western medicine, but in conjunction with, and my family doctor freaked out on every level and kept sending me to a variety of specialists because she didn't agree with what I was doing and kept panicking and sending me to, it was an odd situation. But much like this, you're comparing the different models that are available and what could work better, you know, whether it's a hybrid of, like you say, the ICF is a more universal model of functioning and disability health that has many additional components that the previous medical or social model of disability. Did you want to talk a little bit about the ICF model?
The International Classification of Functioning, yeah. It determines a person's level of functioning based on their health conditions, environmental factors, and personal factors. Mm-hmm. It's a biopsychosocial model of disability using an integration of the social and medical models of disability. I basically suggest that this alternative model is a solution to Canada taking a more unified approach to the autism community's needs. I want my article to demonstrate that there are options other than a medical model of disability that can be implemented into policy in Canada, and that those options should not be overlooked as we move forward in the disability human rights arena and on the autism forefront specifically.
I agree. And you, to close out this part of it, is it is essential to have the government engage and have a deeper understanding of issues like this and accommodate the needs of the autism community and bring us closer to equity in services and realize our rights more fully. Education and training are necessary in reducing stereotypes perpetuated about autism. So that's going back to Ryan's conversation about teachers just not being, and to no fault of their own. We've had amazing teachers, so this is no way a slam against teachers. It is a slam against the system which trains them, which does not prepare them adequately to deal with our diverse cultures that we have in school right now. Perpetuated about autism and to increase understanding of the complex needs of autistic people in order to accommodate them in public spaces where proper accommodations are currently not in place. Inclusive social policies happen when we address how autistic people or people with disabilities are being denied full participation, exposed to prejudicial attitudes, and subject to inaccessible social activities. And this is where one of the things I love about the journal is that those are the opinions that need to be shared to properly influence what's happening now. Again, as a parent, it is frustrating to try and support my son and do the best job when the data is not being collected. You know, going back to Mackenzie's point that the focus is usually on kids. And I remember being, I think it was at my first CASDA conference, and everything stopped at 18. And by day two, I was getting a bit annoyed. because I turned to a fellow attendee and I said, didn't you say your son's 23, 24? She said, yeah. I'm like, my son's 19. Did you know they're not autistic anymore? How cool is that? You know, like, we don't have to advocate at school. We don't have to advocate with health professionals. We don't have to access services. We don't have to get more assessments. I don't have to do another psychoeducational assessment. I don't have to get another occupational assessment. I don't have to do whatever. He is done with being autistic. And she just looked at me and she's like, I never thought about it that way. And I'm like, apparently the rest of the country isn't either. There seems to be this cliff of 18.
Was that a bunch of sarcasm?
It was mixed. It was
okay.
Sarcasm mixed with anger, mixed with incredulity. Because I don't understand how, first of all, we have this incredibly rich, talented pool of autistic Canadians whose voices are not being shared. We have a way to influence policy development and government action, and the people who are affected by it and could influence it in the right way have such a challenge and so many barriers to being that positive influence. And I completely understand, having been there, the importance of focusing on kids, but we cannot forget that this is a lifelong commitment, that just because you turn 18 doesn't mean the problems, in fact, new problems crop up.
So it's sort of a compounding issue when you look at the focus has been on children for so long and it's only stuck with children.
Yep.
So as children age out, it's not, the researchers don't follow them. The funding doesn't follow them.
Yep.
And it's only recently, from my personal experience being in the research community, it's only recently that a lot of funders are now concerned about autism across the lifespan. And previously, when I was doing my doctoral work, it was very hard to find funding. Because I was looking at autistic adults and people were like, well, why aren't you working with children? I said, because everyone's researching children. Why aren't we looking at these adults who have gone through the system and
have a wealth of knowledge and experience to share so that the kids come up through an easier and better created system. We're looking to, what's that? Okay. Somebody's got to help me out here. What is that? I don't know if it's a commercial or whatever, but oh, something about like changing the world better for kids. Is it like a Whitney Houston song? I don't know. No, there's something. Anyway, it'll come to me. But I just.
But it's, I think things have changed in a way that there's more awareness now. And to be fair, there was more awareness even 10 years ago. But I think when you look at the huge jumps in awareness that have happened since autism really entered the public consciousness in the early to mid 90s. All of the people who were kids during that period, whose parents were sort of turned on to sort of sources about autism and things like that at the time, those kids have all grown up now. And yeah. So I think that has really sort of motivated some of the change. You now have people in these funding agencies going, well, my kid with autism and now an adult with autism. Let's see. Oh, wait, there's no research with adults. Why don't we look to fund something like that? So it's very much, it's a very slow process. And there are some people who look at certain segments of the autistic population. I know that there are some researchers looking specifically at seniors on the spectrum. But in general, not many people are looking at adults, and in a way, when you're researching something that no one's really looked at much before, it's both good and bad. It's good because you can sort of you have a lot of freedom in what you can do. It's bad in that you're also very constrained by the standards of your research community. So you may be doing something new and innovative, but the funding mechanisms and the people involved may be using older methods that may not be mm-hmm. as efficient, but then you're sort of trapped into using those methods to maintain your credibility.
To your point, Mackenzie, like we have to, I appreciate the focus on research, but we're going to pull it back to the journal for a second, because you make a really valid point about doing something new and innovative, which the journal is. This is happening in other provinces. You know, CASDA and the Journal of Autism Equity are not claiming to be doing anything brand spanky new, except it's not happening enough. And so one of the advantages of this platform is that it is not just about articles. We've had three incredible articles shared today from, you know, personal perspective, research perspective. But in this journal, there is also poetry. There is also personal stories. There is also opportunity throughout the journal. I think, Megan, if you want to hop back on for a second, we had talked last time about different mediums of expression. So whether it's video, whether it's art, the cover art for this one is done by an autistic Canadian. It's amazing. I don't know if we share the video on this. We might share video, but holy mackerel.
It's absolutely stunning.
This was a cover painting, Beautiful Nightmare by Ryan Smolak. And it's not scary. It's very intriguing. But that's the whole point of the journal, to Mackenzie's point and to Ryan's point and to Rebecca's point about the different voices and the different opportunities to influence. So Megan, confirming, so video, art, poetry.
So we accept anything, because the whole point of it's, you know, everyone has their preferred method of communication, whether it's through poetry, videos, articles, and the whole point of the journal is to talk about equity. And it's not very equitable if we're kind of dictating, gatekeeping what articles we're going to be allowing. So the whole purpose of the journal is you come and you bring your stories, your article, your research, your message, yeah, and you can produce it and present it in any way that is you feel is most comfortable and most true and authentic to your message and whatever you prefer. So this journal accepts everything. So that
it is all vetted. Like, let's just clarify, it is vetted. It is not a free for all. And part of that is because a conversation that we had prior to starting is that there is a variety of viewpoints within the autism community. It's not whitewashed by any stretch, but it's certainly not, it's a place to have a conversation, not an argument. So it is up to the editors what content gets in based on the criteria that they have. Please don't hesitate to submit and we'll give you that information. I just wanted to, before we jump into the last part here, I wanted to share, there is a section on poetry that Terry Robson submitted as part of the journal. And one of the poems that she wrote was, "Who are we? What moment are we in? Strong, resilient, melting down, resentful. What day is this? Good with minor moments of fear and angst. Can I push through? I have some tools in my toolbox. Are they right for this situation? Is it time for hard learning, a search for different tools? Not necessarily better, just new. Struggling with old patterns, behaviors. They don't work with the evolving individual, for better or worse, for the ever-changing group." And I think that, and I don't see it, it doesn't continue, so that's where it ends. But I think that sums up, you know, parts of the conversation today, that we're not looking to dismiss everything that currently exists, but we are looking to include the voices that count to innovate and create things that work. Yes, Rebecca.
Oh, I just wanted to say, because earlier we were talking, and the journal means that First Voices can have a place other than social media to talk about the important issues that face autistic people in Canada as they hope to affect change with their voice. The journal is a place of conversation on how inclusion can grow and where equity really begins. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to do with the journal, and a message that I like to remember when I'm working on it.
Totally agree. And so with the variety of content that currently exists within the journal, Megan, we had started talking before we kicked off about what's the process now for the next issue. So can you jump in on that a little bit?
Yep. So we had a authorship partnership program where individuals who wish to be partnered up with either someone who has years and years of experience in the field that they want to discuss, or if a neurotypical individual wants to connect with an autistic individual to write an article together, we strongly encourage that. So we had that partnership program. Unfortunately, it is closed for this upcoming issue, but for our future issues, it will be reopened once again. So if you ever want to write an article, submit an article, but want someone to be there and help you through it, we definitely have the supports there to create that structure and to connect you with people that would be interested in doing so. On a side note, our submissions are due by July 2nd. So make sure if you're interested in submitting, you submit before the deadline. We're all really interested and excited to read everybody's articles, watch your videos, look at any pictures, art, and we're really looking forward for our next issue, which is going to be focusing on autism, equity, and employment.
Ooh.
Yes.
It's super that after. I might submit an article. No. That's my focus, Ryan. So sorry. That's anyway. So if somebody were looking, they've been inspired and either, so we spoke about this beforehand as well. And the members that you've met today of the editorial team are open to chatting via email on their experience if you have questions. So Megan, what would be the contact information to start that process?
You can reach us at cjae.board@gmail.com. So that's cjae.board@gmail.com.
Okay. And then all emails go there. And then if you have a request for more information or want to connect with somebody on the board, and I know the website for the journal is hosted somewhere differently.
You can just type in cjae.ca and that will bring us directly.
Oh, good.
Super quick and easy. cjae.ca.
But it's hosted
on the McMaster Library of University. But okay. We have it. We simplified the website so it's easier to find us. So yeah, cjae.ca. That's what.
Awesome. Awesome. So are there any, the last part that we tend to do, which we talked about beforehand, is this little share moment. Like Megan's so excited about this. Not really. So Mackenzie, I'm gonna kick off with you. So if you had to, you didn't have to, if you wanted to share something that people wouldn't know about you or assume about you, what would that be?
Well, see, I'm very stereotypically nerdy. So any of the quote embarrassing stuff, most people could probably guess. But I will say I am a big Iron Maiden fan, and most people would not think that of me.
Okay, I was just losing my left lung in a little coughing fit there. Iron Maiden, well, that's cool. Mm-hmm. All right, Ryan.
I haven't planned to share the whole multiple degree thing, but I've already used that up. So I am a huge fan of Heart, the band Heart.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I like them too. Who's it? Nancy Wilson. She's one heck of a guitarist. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Ann Wilson can belt it out as well. They performed at a recent Kennedy Center event, but I can't remember who they were celebrating, but they did a cover of one of the honorees and holy mackerel. Was it ever fantastic?
Led Zeppelin?
Could have been. Oh, thank you, Mackenzie. I believe it was. She could hit the notes that Robert Plant. Oh, very cool. Rebecca?
Well, I was born a long time ago, so I like 90s alternative music. And one of the bands that I really like is Bush. And I had the opportunity at a concert in Vancouver to have Bush... Gavin Rossdale sing with me a song, and that was like terrifying and afterwards very cool, but the whole experience was like one of those
surreal.
Anxiety. Yeah, exactly. I'm like, what's happening to me?
Which I'm sure a lot of people have the same, you know, I can't believe it, but how awesome was that?
Yeah, he just came up with his microphone and he was like, I'm singing, you're singing, I'm singing, you're singing.
You're like, okay.
And my friends got it all on video and they were just like, oh my goodness.
Oh, that's ever cool. See? Now, Megan, are you kind of come up with something? Because you've been on a lot now, so it gets kind of harder, but we have a dog that snores.
Yes.
We have, I can't remember the type of music, emoji. Something odd. I don't know.
I love, well, my phone playlist is just full of emo and screamo music mixed with classical music. So it's really off-putting for a lot of people.
What is screamo? Is screamo, it literally?
It's pretty much as it is. It's like emo, punk, hard rock back in like the 2000s. It's just essentially a bunch of screaming. So
Angry connect- music.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So, I was actually at the library. It's connected to this. So I was actually at the library once, and I had my headphones in and suddenly my Bluetooth cut off. So throughout the library at McGill, you just hear screamo music because the song was just ending, right? So, and I have my music super loud. I love super loud music. So it was screamo music for like about a second, and then all of a sudden you have a bunch of classical music playing, and the stares, the absolute stares I got were like, people were angry that it was super loud because it's a library, but then everyone was so confused. It was both embarrassing, but now as I look back, it was a very funny time of my time at McGill.
It's not like you got up and your skirt was tucked into your underwear or something. So, I mean, that's not a... Well, I mean, what's my share? So my share this time is my friend and I we have been friends since we were 9 years old. So that's 42 years now, which is crazy. Have designed our friendship tattoo. So thank you. I already have one. So we're going for number two. And we've been going back and forth, and we both have Germanic roots in England. So we were trying to tie that up. So essentially it's going to be, so the flower that represents friendship is Alstroemeria, and we are also both gardeners. So we are going to get Alstroemeria with two bees, one for each of us, in our tattoo. So that'll be coming up in the next. So next time I can share it if we do video, because it's, and it was nice because she shared, I think I've shared this part before, but she found me as I was out for a walk. I'm not a huge fan of crying in public, and she phoned me and she said, I've decided where the tattoo is going to go. I said, oh, okay, cool. Like, what are you going to do? She said, I'm going to put it on my back of my right shoulder. And I said, why? And she said, because you always have my back and you're always there to lend a hand. And I'm walking in public. I'm not very nice. I'm crying. And there are people here. It was like a 14-year-old hot mess. Just to go back to the beginning, 14-year-old hot mess is what I was.
It's so sweet. Absolutely adorable. Sorry.
That's what we do.
These things make my heart melt.
So to wrap up, if you have been listening and you are inspired to get involved with the Canadian Journal of Autism Equity, please get in touch. Megan, I'm going to get you to repeat the email again.
It's cjae.board@gmail.com.
And that's the opportunity to submit content and get in touch. If you want to speak to one of the members of the board, there are other members that we're going to be interviewing at another time. And add your voice to the conversation. The whole goal, and this is across Canada. So we're coming to you from Ontario and BC right now. But any province, anywhere in Canada, I believe it's any topic, although the theme for next time is autism, equity, and employment. So if that hits a button for you, then this is the journal to share that in. From my research, we are now in the third generation of autistic Canadians trying to gain and maintain employment, and services have not caught up since the first generation. So there is a lot of ground to gain to create that equity. Anybody out there doing work on supporting that and changing that, we would love to hear from you. And if everybody can come off mic, off mute for just a second, because we're going to wrap up. There we go. And I just want to say thank you very much, everybody, for joining us today and sharing your voices. I'm inspired and appreciative.
Thank you for having me.
And so everybody's going to stay on for a couple of minutes, but we're just all going to say thanks and goodbye. And we will see you on our next issue of the CASDA podcast. So everybody can just say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
And we will talk to you soon. Thank you very much, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you for joining the conversation about the National Autism Strategy. CASDA is a comprehensive network of autistic Canadians and autism-focused organizations. Our members are united by the shared vision that a national autism strategy will create improvements in the lives of autistic people for generations to come. Please visit CASDA.ca to learn more and keep the conversation going.